Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show, your source for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We've got a number of national headlines we want to be able to discuss with you today. And I first want to introduce my guest for this morning. First, we have Rob Mariani, who is with us via phone, and he's the opinion editor for the Daily Caller. Good morning, Rob.
Hey there. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for being here. Then we also have my colleague from UMBC, Dr. Tom Schaller, who is a professor of political science as well as chair of that department. And he is also a writer of a political column for the Baltimore Sun. And his most recent book is called The Stronghold, How Republicans Captured Congress but Surrendered the White House. Good morning, Dr. Schaller.
Hi, Kimberly.
Good to have you. And we will also be joined later by Adar Ayiri, who is the project manager of the More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities. She's also the facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnership. She will join us a little later, but I'll start with the gentleman. In particular, Dr. Schaller, I want to hear your take on the recent visit of Donald Trump visiting a black church in Detroit.
Well, I think Trump is, I guess, trying to broaden his appeal to a more inclusive audience. And by that, of course, we mean a non-white segment of the American population. He's, you know, done a variety of things since he first declared a year ago, June, to offend, you know, Muslim Americans, Latino Americans, African Americans. But he seems particularly to believe that he has a chance with African Americans by parlaying his immigration stance with the argument that immigrant labor is taking jobs away from and or driving down the wages of jobs of American citizens, including African American citizens. And so I think this is an appeal for him to try to take as many African American votes away from Hillary Clinton, particularly in states like a Michigan, I suppose, a Pennsylvania, Ohio, Florida, where those votes could actually matter, of course, in swing states to affect the general election outcome.
Yeah, so what I'm hearing is the fear appeal tactic is still being used by the campaign in hopes of that being what will push or drive African-American voters towards him and away from Hillary.
I think so. And, you know, I don't know how much black-brown tension there is and how much of a perception there is that the jobs that are taken by immigrants, whether they're naturalized citizens now or whether they're undocumented workers, is a direct threat or a direct, you know, sort of drain on black labor participation or black economic prospects. Trump is banking, I think, on that idea, even though at least the polls seem to indicate that African Americans are buying it.
Right. I mean, I think one of the latest polls that I read said that he's still only at about 1% of the African American voters.
Yes, I think, you know, when you're within the polling margin of error of zero, it's hard to imagine that, you know, that you're going to do very well. On the other hand, the counterargument, frankly, is there's no place to go but up. And
which is what he said, too.
Right. I mean, and given where, you know, coming out of two elections in which we had the first African-American presidential candidate of a major party and winner twice, Barack Obama, you could argue that Democrats have reached their ceiling and that now that they have a non-black candidate at the top of, and the bottom of the ticket, there is the possibility for shaking loose some African-American votes. And frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if Hillary Clinton does worse than Barack Obama did, both in his share. I think the more interesting question is the level of turnout among African-Americans. Hillary Clinton can certainly win the election with, say, 90% of the black vote as white Democrats before Barack Obama, including John Kerry and Al Gore did. But if the turnout is low, even at 90%, that could potentially make a difference in a close race where, you know, in Ohio or Pennsylvania is pivotal.
Yeah. So, Rob, I want to hear your contribution to this, because what I also find interesting is you do see the Trump campaign rallying, or at least attempting to rally more black ministers behind his campaign to almost tap into the community through their religious leaders to suggest that blacks have been dumbfounded and convinced that the Democratic Party is for them and in their corner when in fact they are not. And so now is the time to come in our direction.
Sure. And that might be a good strategy just because, you know, the civil rights movement actually had a very, people often forget this, a very strong religious underpinning to it. You know, I believe, you know, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., he had a doctorate in theology. He was a reverend. Mm-hmm. You know, the big question is, you know, whether Trump's right about, you know, immigration or illegal immigration or any of that, you know, hurting the ability of black people to participate in the economy. I mean, like, that, I think that's more of an academic question than it is a political question. You know, Barack Obama, he got 95% of the black vote in 2008 and, you know, 93% in 2012 after his approval ratings went down. Bill Clinton, you know, people joked, you know, in his office that he was the first black president.
Right.
Because he had so much, you know, support among African Americans. I think it was extremely high. I think it was actually in the 80s. Don't quote me on that, but it was, you know, this number seems to be climbing for Democrats. And Hillary Clinton, people paint her, for better or worse, with her husband's brush. And so I think, you know, Bernie Sanders did everything he could to possibly, you know, bring black people over to his side. So, you know, and it might have even made sense because, you know, he was a candidate that was running as supposedly a social Democrat or a democratic socialist even. And he was appealing to some of the people who are kind of fall through the cracks of the economy the most. So you think he would have done better than Hillary Clinton, who, you know, supported the TPP, wasn't as hard on the minimum wage. But, you know, the fact remains is that whatever is the reality of these policy positions, that wasn't actually expressed in the numbers of votes. So ultimately, I think it comes down to the fact that black people don't like Donald Trump. They don't like Republicans. And what Trump might be doing now is a waste of time. Republicans have repeatedly, you know, held rallies and conferences during the election season in Detroit, but they never win Detroit. You know, Michigan's a blue state. It's going to stay a blue state. I just don't think this is a strategy that makes much sense any way you look at it.
Yeah. Adara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It looks like you've got plenty to say.
You know, it's always amazing to me how African Americans as a voter clientele are painted. Mm. And number one, African Americans, African descendants are intelligent voters who, like any other voter in America, vote their interest. And if they are not voting Republicans, it is because Republicans do not have those policy positions, nor the languaging, nor the context that speak to African descendants. And I think that when we talk about these issues, that is the thing that we spend so little time on. I do not believe that Republicans should concede the black vote. I think that Republicans need to understand the black vote and understand that instead of black people looking for quote unquote free stuff, which is how I heard one media outlet refer to Donald Trump's visit. They said, oh, he didn't promise free stuff. and that is such meta conversation, right? That creates a narrative about African descendants and how and why they vote.
So talk to me about, because during his speech, it seemed that he tried to convey or tried to claim the party of Lincoln, which I hear often in the rhetoric of a number mm-hmm. of Republicans to try and create or create a narrative that says you're following the wrong party, because in fact, here's what we have to offer and look at who we are following. So why do you continue to support the Democrats?
You know, and that's kind of like Bernie Sanders saying that he marched with Martin Luther King Jr. I mean, people were saying, but what have you done since then?
Right.
And I think that is the question also for Republicans. What have you done since then? Just turning up at a black church and looking, if I may say, extremely uncomfortable. but turning up at a black church at election time especially when you are not addressing the allegations of your own relationship, documented relationship with the Black community before then. Again, nothing happens outside of a larger societal context. And we've got to stop treating our conversations as if it does.
Right. And so it sounds like what I'm hearing from all three guests is that the presence of Omarosa Manigault really isn't helping Trump much at all.
When I heard that she was the person that he got, it was a laugh out loud moment for me.
Anyone else?
I mean, this is Tom Schaller again. You know, it's hard to take Trump seriously given some of those tweets that he sent out earlier about race and crime and convictions. But, you know, this notion that he is trying to appeal to people who've been left behind in the economy, I think that is a theme that whether Trump or Sanders or other water carriers, including our former governor, Martin O'Malley, and just other people in general, was and is one that in an era of rising inequality, which of course has its own racial dimensions to it, is one to be taken seriously. That doesn't mean Donald Trump is the best or even a good water carrier for that message, but that is a message that is resonating with people who feel that the political system is rigged, the economic system is rigged, some of them think the electoral system is rigged as well, but in any case, the data do bear out a growing disparity between haves and have-nots, and as we both all know, those in the have-not side of the ledger are disproportionately African-American.
Right.
And to mention the growing economic inequality outside of the racialized context, or with the racialized context as a side dish instead of on the main platter,
right,
is not really appealing to those people who are left behind, who understand that this is happening within a racialized context that is historical.
Kimberly, if I could just add one little point here, is that, you know, Republicans have been criticized for a long time for not really addressing this issue of economic inequality and poverty and disparity and other sorts of problems, whether they're Black, white, or inner city, just in general. And I think what we have seen with Trump, and there's were early warning signs. There's a book by Ross Douthat, New York Times columnist, and Raihan Salam saying the GOP needs a middle class, you know, policy strategy. And we saw a little whiff of this in Mike Huckabee's campaign and even in Rick Santorum's campaign over the last two cycles, previous two cycles, saying, you know, poverty is a Christian issue and inequality is a problem and one we need to address. To me, what's fascinating about Trump, whatever else one thinks of him, and I say very little positively about him, is that the Republican Party could not hear that message until Donald Trump, that they were not talking about these things at all. And whether Trump is talking about them in the right way, whether his promises and plans would actually do anything, or whether this is just a naked ploy for votes, we can have that discussion. But the fact that all this was left on the table, immigration, jobs, and trade by a Republican Party, it shows how out of touch they were, not just with Americans abroad, but their own voters. And to me, that is the fascinating big takeaway from this election, regardless of what happens in November.
You make a very key point that I just want to make sure that I encourage folks to call in with your comments at 410-319-8888 or tweet us at Mark Steiner, comment on the Mark Steiner Facebook page, or feel free to send us an email to talk@steinershow.org. Rob, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I think the characterization of Trump as sort of a shift away from the hardline, you know, free market fundamentalist part of the Republican ethos is correct. And, you know, I would describe Trump as a Rockefeller Republican who happens to be a hawk on immigration. He supports, you know, he's pro-Planned Parenthood. He's pro-raising the minimum wage. He's all sorts of interventionism and protectionism. So I have trouble understanding this, you know. This is something that's always levied at Republicans, this kind of claim that's like, all you have to do is be more like Democrats, and you can tap into these, you know, non-white voter bases. Trump, you know, he's more like a Democrat than any Republican presidential candidate in recent memory, which is, you know, that's why the GOP establishment doesn't like him. So I'm not sure, besides becoming a Democrat, what he could even do to be more like a Democrat and have policy positions that, you know, non-white voters prefer. Like, what could he do anymore?
So what I also find interesting, going back to our earlier point that Dr. Schaller raised for us, is, you know, Trump has created a persona as the non-politician at the table. And with that, he's given himself a great deal of latitude on things that he can say or not say that most politicians would not do. Does this visit to the black church and starting this process of making claims or offering something free, does that shift his role as the non-politician at the table, or are folks still very much seeing him as, you know, the one who is becoming very much like a traditional politician? Adar.
I don't know. And and let me tell you why I don't know. I don't know because on any given day, at any given hour, Donald Trump's position will seem to shift, or he will go back on something that he said in a way that we and we're used to politicians doing this. So I guess in that respect, he is right in line with a traditional politician. But the way in which we as society, as voters, as media, the way that we talk about his doing that is so different. The accountability to which we hold him for having done that is so different than we do with any other politician.
Absolutely.
So in that respect, I think that we need to ask ourselves what's going on with us that we give him this pass as opposed to what's going on with him.
Okay. Gentlemen.
Well, I would just add one thing to what the laundry list that Rob added. Sorry to cut you off, Rob, which is Social Security and Medicare, which Trump said he's not going to touch. And that is a massive departure from
Absolutely.
The sort of Paul Ryan institutional establishment wing of the Republican Party, which has been trying to reform or whatever. And again, that was another signal, even older than the ones that I mentioned before in terms of the Grand New Party book and the Santorum and Huckabee campaigns. George W. Bush, after re-election, decided to spend all that political capital from the 2004 re-election on Social Security reform, and he made it about 2 weeks before he just completely fell on his face and gave up, which shows you that the Republican Party was out of touch even with its older, whiter voters who are the disproportionate recipients of Social Security, Medicare, and even Medicaid, 72% of the recipients of whom are senior citizens as well. Now, Michael Lind and other commentators have said this is really welfare for older white people, and we could have that argument, and maybe Trump needs to explain in audiences like Detroit why he doesn't support Obamacare, but he's for Social Security and Medicare,
right?
Because there are clear generational, therefore racial aspects to that divergence. But the fact of the matter is that Donald Trump is not a traditional Republican in the sense that he is, for at least parts of the welfare state, strongly supportive of it.
Rob, you wanted to add in?
Oh, yeah. I mean, just so I was reading a blog post by a linguist. I forget where it was. I wish I could dig it up. But it examined how Trump gives speeches. Some speeches or speeches of any kind. And the way he speaks is more like the average person than either a very educated, you know, upper middle class person or a politician, just because.
But that's his stick, right? I mean, that's what people like about him.
Sure, but I'm saying, but people who are traditional politicians speak, their speech can be very translated into punctuated written words. Trump speaks off the cuff and speaks, you know, as if there wasn't really traditional punctuation rules there. And for better or worse, you know, that separates him immensely from Hillary Clinton, who, you know, she's criticized as robotic. She's criticized as, you know,
career
having
politician.
Hundreds of people that she's filtered through. You know, she's focus group corporate made.
Right.
And you know, Trump has shifted more towards a politician, you know, because of the pressure of the Republican establishment. And honestly, his supporters have criticized him, that Mr. Trump, it's time to get serious. We have an election to win. You can't just treat this as, you know, being funny on the cable television. So I think he has had a push a little towards the traditional politician side, and that's, you know, probably what his supporters and the Republican establishment wanted.
Yes. We've got William on hold, who wants to offer his perspective on presidential candidate Trump. Good morning, William.
Hi, good morning. My take on Trump is that I don't think that I don't really take him seriously as a presidential candidate, but he's spoken to so much of what the white working class is going through. Because I remember reading in New York Times article in 2012 about the Democratic playbook for that campaign. And part of that playbook basically set aside the white working class to pursue the demographics that were much more on an upsurge. Basically, poor minorities, college-educated whites. And the white working class constituency, which has been part of the Democrats since, like, forever, was just sort of cast aside and was left there in this election cycle to be picked up by somebody like Donald Trump.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your comment, William. I think you are correct that Trump has been able to tap into that particular group of people who feel like they have been left out of the political process, and this is their opportunity to have a candidate to capitalize on just that. So we're going to head out for break very quickly, but while we're on our way to break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, please contact www.meq.com. Again, I'm Kimberly Moffitt filling in for Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9, the voice of the community. We want to continue our conversation about Trump and his candidacy thus far. In particular, I want to shift gears for a moment and talk about Trump's recent visit to Mexico on the other side of this potential wall that he wants to build, but also just to hear what his immigration policy is. And actually, this is an opportunity for me to learn from the astute panel that we have on the air today, for I am still at a loss of what that immigration policy looks like. So if we can start, Dr. Shalit, can you shed some light on this for us?
Oh, I'm supposed to be the cryptic one with the special mood ring translator? That's not. Why do I get called out first? I feel like the kid in the back of the room is playing on his phone, doesn't know what the hell's going on. You've had that experience, right, Kimberly?
Oh, absolutely.
Here's my political take on it, which is I think what Trump tried to do with this Mexico trip, and then less so, you could argue, the speech, though, if you listen to the speech, it's really about the difference, I think, again, I'm not sure here, about cracking down on immigrants who are criminals than people who are criminal by virtue of their immigration status. Right. And I think their gambit here is that has a much stronger pull on a broader electorate than just simply saying immigration is illegal. Now, I realize he's talking about touchbacks and people having to go back and get in line. That's the more traditional hardline Republican view. But if you listen to the speech, it was more about people who are taking welfare benefits and people who are murdering people. He brought up all those parents of murdered children and trying to say, you know, how could you be against people who commit crimes who are immigrants? And, of course, the answer is I'm not. I mean, right. I'm against immigrants committing crime the same as regular Americans committing crime. And Trump and his supporters will never mention, of course, that the crime rates among first-generation immigrants is actually lower than it is for the American citizenry as a whole. So if you really want to solve murder, we should be ending with the immigrants instead of starting with the immigrants. But let's put the facts aside, because this is a fact-free American political environment. I think what he's trying to do is say – is take the small subset of people who commit rapes and murders and other economic crimes, because who are not citizens, and rounding them all up and sending them back to their home countries, because that is a more broadly popular and harder to sort of counteract position, other than what I just said, which is crimes are crimes regardless of who commits them.
Right. All right. So Rob, Dr. Schaller didn't take the bite. Help me out. What is Trump's immigration policy?
Well, he's actually done something sort of historic, and that is that he's actually talked about reducing legal immigration rather than just tackling illegal immigration. Not even Republicans talked about this before. They would talk about cracking down on illegal immigration, like, send these lawbreakers home. And Obama, he's actually done kind of that same thing, too. He's said, the people who commit crimes, who cause us problems here at home, they're going to be the ones we prioritize. But on the flip side of that, Obama and I think Hillary Clinton, who has a similar position on immigration, they want to increase legal immigration. And even, hardline Republicans like in the 1990s, when this was also an issue, they never talked about actually lowering the level of people coming to the country legally. And I think there's a sort of something tangential to this. I think Trump is trying to tap into this, murdered, whatever, these people's families were murdered by illegal immigrants. What he's trying to do there is, I think, something similar to, what sort of some people say lost Dukakis the election. I think that was in 1980 or 84 maybe against Reagan. He's a Democratic nominee. And when he was the governor of Massachusetts, he had this policy where he, allowed people, even violent criminals, to have furloughed sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
one of the people who was furloughed under that...
killed someone.
Killed someone.
Yeah.
And, I think Trump is trying to sort of spin this in a way. It's like, look.
Wasn't that the Willie Horton?
Hillary Clinton is doing what Dukakis is doing.
Yeah, I think that was the Willie Horton case.
No.
Yeah, Willie Horton. That's the one. Thank you.
Was it Willie Horton?
Who was the North Carolina with the hands?
Oh, that was Jesse Helms.
Oh, okay, right.
That was Jesse Helms.
It's been so many who have played into the racial or racialized paranoia mm-hmm. that has historically been a huge selling and voting mm-hmm. point for our country.
It worked for Jesse Helms.
It worked
well.
For him. But Donald Trump now, he has... Oh, and I'm sorry, because I don't want to step on... Were you finished your point?
Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
So Donald Trump, in his own words, has said this. He said, when Mexico sends its people, they're not sending the best. They're not sending people like you. They're sending people with problems. They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. And some, I assume, are good people. And he goes on. There are many quotes that he has made or that have been made in his name on his Twitter account like that. He even talked about Jeb Bush having to like Mexican illegals because of his wife. He talked about Jeb Bush speaking Spanish and saying, this is America. Stop speaking Mexican. Speak English. So we have to be very clear that historically, when we talk about immigration, basically what we have talked about is immigration policies impacting people of color coming into this country. And now we've expanded it not only to people of color, but to people who are Muslims coming into this country, a great many of them who are people of color. So let's, as we talk about the conversation, let's talk about it within the larger context in which Donald Trump has offered it.
Mm-hmm.
So, when Trump said what he did about, Mexico's not sending their best, he said it in a crude way, but it wasn't exactly untrue. The average illegal immigrant is nothing like the average Mexican. So that's what he was gesturing at. This is a Mexican underclass that is sort of, in his view, is our problem now. It's not the Mexican middle class, not even the Mexican, they're typical workers. People took issue with his tone, but if you're talking about they're not sending their best, they're sending their underclass, that's correct. That's a fact.
I think that what people really took issue with is the fact that he he painted with broad brush a whole group, a whole race of people. And we know that there are people who have immigrated from Mexico into this country, people who are Latino in this country, who are not the rapists, the robbers, the criminals.
That's exactly what he was
with
doing.
Which he painted them with that broad brush.
People with that brush. He said specifically, Mexico's not sending their best. This isn't all Mexicans. This is the ones, you know, these are the underclass of Mexico that form the bulk of illegal immigrants.
And again, larger context.
What's essential to Hispanic?
Why do you think that he talked about that the Mexican judge, who actually was born here, I believe,
yes,
in the way that he talked about him? I'm just saying that there is a larger dog whistle, not even a dog whistle, a bullhorn tone that also is connected to Donald Trump. And to pretend like that's not there is just disingenuous on our parts.
So we have Russ that's on the line and wants to offer his commentary about presidential candidate Trump. Good morning, Russ.
Greetings to all.
Thank you.
What I wanted to point out is simply this. The people who support Trump don't give a hoot about policy or plans or anything else. To get my drift on this point, let's translate Trump speak into ghetto speak. Let's make America great again. Ghetto speak, let's make America white again. Let's get white folks back in charge. I'm the law and order candidate. That means get the Native Americans back on the reservation, the darkies in jail, and let's get the Muslims out. So this is the kind of thing that his core representation did. That's how he got through the primaries. So if you're sitting there waiting for some policy that Trump is going to say today and mean tomorrow, you might be sitting for a while.
Thank you for clarifying that for me, Russ. I mean, because I really, as someone who I believe follows this campaign quite closely, I have really struggled to understand in detail what Donald Trump is offering us in terms of immigration policy. And I just don't hear it. I hear a number of words, but I'm not hearing anything of substance that gives me a sense of what to look for once and if he becomes president of this country. Adara, did you want to add?
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, I cannot wait for the debates.
I still think he's going to try something.
You know what? I am just hoping to hear a cohesive, comprehensive, or even a little snippet at this point of policy. You know, we get so caught up into discussing issues that have nothing to do with the economic and social policies of America. And
I think that's by plan.
Yeah. And all I want is let's hear something so that we're not here trying to conjecture or look into a crystal ball to figure out what he's saying in terms of immigration or any other policy. If he would just spit it out, which I hope he will do during the debate, then we can have a conversation based on what he has said about policy.
Yeah, but he hasn't said hardly anything, as Brian said.
I know.
He has 9,000 words on covering only 7 policies on his website. Now, a website is one thing, and you can supplement that with other documents or statements in public, but, you know, this is not a policy-rich environment. And it doesn't mean Hillary Clinton's a better candidate just because she has whatever it is, 110,000 words. She has about 10 times as much discussing like 5 times as many topics. But he's not really running a policy campaign, and that is very disconcerting, regardless of what you think of his politics or his ideology, that a presidential campaign and a presidential candidate can take so few stands and be so unclear and just run largely an insult and personality-based campaign. It's frankly very discouraging and borderline frightening.
Absolutely. We have Bill on the line who wanted to offer his commentary. Good morning, Bill.
Yes, first let me just say hello to everybody.
Good morning.
And I wasn't going to talk, but I want to just get some clarity on what the gentleman said. When he said that Donald Trump was spending the underclass in terms of referencing it to not the best, I just would like a description of the underclass, because if you say that, then that can apply to any of us who happens to not be on the top. So all of us could be underclass in our own particular country. So I just need to be clear in terms of what he's saying about that.
So So he was one of our callers, Bill, and I think the perspective he was trying to offer is that there is a group of people who have been silent or at least marginalized in a lot of the politics of recent years or even recent decades, and that this was their candidate to actually voice the voice of the silent majority so that they were no longer hidden, but in fact given a platform to say, we're here too, please hear us. Did anyone else want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. You know, 20 years ago, all these Trump supporters, these middle class or even I guess working class white folks, they were solid Democrats. They wouldn't think voting Republican. What's shifted, you know, in my opinion, is that, you know, the Democratic Party has become more of a party of ethnic patronage politics. This is the type of politics that you see in not very successful democracies. You know, in Nigeria, you'll have parties and candidates that their normal way of interacting with the electorate is promising the Igbo or Yoruba people things. And that results in very suboptimal policy for the country. India is the same way, a very multi-ethnic country, and party politics is basically, you know, battling over who's going to take the pie from the other guy. So, you know, I think Bernie Sanders was an interesting flip side of this. He isn't really doing this like the Democratic Party has been doing for a long time. In West Virginia, all these white working class folks were supporting him. And then the exit polls, when they asked, Bernie Sanders voters after they left the polls for him, 35% of them said they'd vote for Donald Trump after him. So something's changed about the Democratic Party. All Catholics used to be Democrats in the 1950s. You know, then the party became the party of, you know, the sacred right of late-term abortion. Now it's about 50-50. So something's changed.
So America has always had ethnic patronage politics. It is just that was never a problem when it worked for majority white populations.
Okay.
I mean, is that true? We might have different definitions of ethnic patronage.
Well, you know what? And we probably do, because when I talk about ethnic patronage, I include white people as part of an ethnicity and a race in America.
Sure,
and
yeah.
Most of the times when we talk about ethnic patronage politics, we don't talk about white people. In fact, we talk about white people as if their interests are universal interests and they have no wants, no patronage, no anything. That's the way that we talk about them. And I'm saying that if we're taking a historical perspective in looking at the politics, the electorate, and all of our policies, including Social Security, which at the time that it was established did not allow black people to take from the pool, even though black people were putting into the pool. If we're looking at all of that, then there cannot be any doubt that what we're talking about historically is America's historical ethnic patronage political history.
Sure. But what I think it comes right down to is that white people didn't think of it this way.
Of course they didn't.
Of
course they didn't.
No, this whole fear about this white identity politics thing rising with Trump is precisely new because this is...
It's not new. No, it's not. No, it is not new. Stop that. Stop that. We're going to have to take out our history books.
That's what we're talking about on cable news.
It white ethnic politics, white racial politics is nothing new. It was in the labor unions. It was in the political parties. It was in our policy. It was in every single aspect of American life. And one of the reasons that, you know, that you and others, usually white, can make that statement is the way that our history, including our political history, is taught in America, and the way that that is hidden by our looking at whiteness as being universal and normalized in America.
So I'm taking it you're not worried about any, you know, white ethnic patronage party. You're just saying this is sort of a normal thing. And that's a completely neutral thing.
Whether it is normal and whether I'm worried, those are two different things. What I'm addressing right now is that is normal in America.
Here's my one question. Should that be the case for white people? Should they be pursuing their ethnic interests?
I think that we should all be pursuing the interest of justice. And in our country, that has not necessarily been the path that we have pursued.
It's often been racialized, even justice.
It has all been racialized. And not only that, but the majority population that has been pursuing justice have been those very groups that we now want to look at and say that they are ethnic patronage politics. Those are the groups that have been on the front lines always historically in this country of pursuing justice in politics and in social and in economic life.
My fear is that this leads to suboptimal policy. You know, there have been studies on this, more ethnic patronage politics.
And I'm saying that it's always been that way. That's the way that it has always been. This is not new.
Let's put the number at 40% in America. Then people have put at 60% in India, 100% in Nigeria. And in countries like Norway and New Zealand, about 10%. And there's been a very, very strong correlation between actual optimal policy outcomes and that number I just gave you. This is something to be worried about.
Well, I mean, the United States is fundamentally different from a country like Iceland or Norway or Japan in that we're less monolithic. This is the great blessing and the great challenge of American politics. But I think what Kimberly is saying is that, you know, we don't.
Kimberly is shaking her head.
For lack of a better term, the prevailing example of white privilege is the one that I mentioned before, which is that 40% of U.S. federal spending goes to three programs alone, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And those programs, of course, include African Americans and others, but they disproportionately go to the oldest generation, which is the whitest generation. And there's very little concern, I mean, outside of Paul Ryan's fantasies, of deconstructing any of those. But we have a constant chorus of repeal and replace Obamacare, which is for the first time in American history, a social welfare program that is geared toward the younger generation and those who do not have health care in an American society where the two biggest tax preferences, Rob, the two biggest tax preferences that reduce the government revenues are the employer health care subsidy, which is about $255 billion a year, and the mortgage subsidy, which is about $90 billion a year. That's a third of $1 trillion every year that the government loses in revenues. And those programs, by definition, go to whom? Homeowners and people who have jobs. Right? So when we talk about entitlements, it's mostly entitlements to upper-middle-class people and older people. And who are those people? Those people aren't uniformly white, but they're disproportionately white, and we never even call into question those programs.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I have to give that all the credit goes to Adar for offering that perspective, Tom. I was simply trying to manage it as the two were talking about such a complex but really interesting topic. We're going to break now. And even though we didn't even have the opportunity to talk about the Kaepernick issue, and I want to make sure that I acknowledge my colleague, Dr. Tom Schaller, who has to leave us at this time, as well as Rob Mariani for joining us and contributing to such a very tense-filled but important conversation at play. So thank you so much.
Thank you for the great conversation.
And we will be back in just a short moment.